Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, excited about things that we have on deck for tonight. Going to be just kind of a broad, open-ended discussion about a couple things that we've personally talked about as we kind of shift our focus to next year. And just a couple general points and observations that surround the program. So excited for just kind of a laid-back conversation. What this podcast was, not that we ever have screaming matches or throw things off the desk, but be good to just bounce some ideas back and forth. And with that, want to thank our friends at Louisiana Hot Sauce that always make this podcast possible. National sale on Publix this week, I believe, on Louisiana. Get you a chance to get the large bottle, I think, for somewhere between 20, well, I shouldn't say the exact percentage, but a significant savings on either size. And what is always a very budget-friendly option only became all the more easy to include in your shopping trip. So if you go to the store, chance to grab a bottle, support the Nolcast at a particularly low price. And always want to thank our friends at Louisiana for the assistance that they've provided us and the partner that they've been for nearly a year now.
And when you think about it, Louisiana Hot Sauce is probably one of the only condiments that you actually want to use breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, I guess some people put ketchup on some stuff, but like most people don't use mayo or mustard for breakfast, right? Mm. But most people, I think, or not most, but at least a lot of people put hot sauce on their eggs. And I was going through our excellent iTunes, or as it's now called, Apple Podcast reviews. We always appreciate those 5-star reviews. And Noel78 yesterday or the day before said, "Outstanding, insightful analysis of FSU football. I listen when I go to the gym, hike the mountains of North Carolina. And yes, I use Louisiana hot sauce on most everything. It's excellent on broccoli." I've never had it on broccoli. Have you?
I have. That's a really good...
It's legit?
It's a good observation, yeah. It's legit, and we've mentioned that Louisiana is friendly on the budget, and it can also be friendly for a way to spice up what some other times can be maybe not a bland diet, but a repetitive diet. So we've had a couple different people that have emailed us about the way that they've used it, and whether it be, Whole 30 or a couple others. So it's a great option. For a variety of reasons, and as we always do, want to thank them for the pairing that they've been able to provide for us. So, but with that, why don't we just go ahead and move into what we had talked about, have a couple general subjects that we want to cover, and excited to see where this podcast goes.
Yeah, Ingram, let's start out with some gambling, which is either legal or illegal, depending mostly on where you live. You know, it's sort of a rite of the off season when the initial over-under regular season win total options come out. And it looks like this week we have had three come out. Over-unders on FSU of 10.5, 10, and 9.5, all at different casinos. Now, understand this. Wager options that come out this early in the year typically have rather low limits. Nobody can go in and drop down 10,000 on Florida State over or under, or at least most people can't. Maybe if you have like an established line of credit or something. You know, the casinos want to throw it out there. They want to get the opinions of both the public and also the sharps. They want to sort of refine their number as they approach later on in the offseason, where they will actually increase their maximum bet limit size in order to sort of have a better, more hammered out number, if you will. This is kind of like a piece of iron you're just pulling out of the fire, right? It's being hammered on all different sides. But I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on this. First of all, that's you know, not a hugely wide range, but it's a full win depending on where you're looking. 10 seems to be kind of the common theme here. With the 9.5, the juice is to the over. With the 10.5, the juice is to the under. And 10 is kind of the more neutral number. Do you think that's an appropriate number for this FSU team? Were you surprised when this came out?
You're right. It's also it's a piece of steel that they kind of make malleable, but it's also a nice little seed to just plant this conversation in the back of your mind and to have people like us or local radio or anybody else talk about. So certainly with some strategic ideas to why and when you see these things get floated out there. To answer your question directly, the only thing that immediately moves me, and I'm nothing but, I'm a simpleton when it comes to this and don't put my toe in the waters of gambling, but the 9.5 is the only thing that I would instantly move on. That is something that I would take advantage of as much as I could for the limit, but that's the only one that I immediately feel comfortable about.
I think I would too, assuming that the juice on it wasn't too high. But if you're having to pay, you know, -200 or 2-1 type juice on that thing, that's prohibitive. You know, at that point, that's gets to be really costly. I went back and did some research. The here are the win totals, and again, we're talking just regular seasons, no conference championship, no playoff, no bowl game. Mm-hmm. Those wins do not count in this. It's just your 12-game schedule. If you have a game canceled, obviously the wager's canceled. Jimbo, so far in his career at Florida State, has won 9, 8, 10, 12, 12, 10, and 9 for an average of 10, which, you know, this number is right in line with his career averages. Now, obviously, those two that I said that were 12s had a guy named Jameis Winston quarterbacking the team. And I think there are various levels of confidence in Jimbo Fisher without Jameis. Some of those assumptions I think people make that he can't win without him are a bit unfair, but the win total numbers are on their side. If you read his 5 seasons without Jameis, he has gone 9-3, 8-4, 10-2, 10-2, and 9-3. So he's not hit 11 or 12 at all in the regular season without Winston, which I think speaks to just how hard it is to do that, right? Jimbo's like the third most winningest coach during his career here, basically behind Saban and I think maybe Meyer. That's ridiculous. But it's still really hard to go 11-1 or 12-0, and that result is absolutely not guaranteed. This could be a year where not only does FSU not make the playoff, but it's really not that difficult to see the ACC getting left out of the playoff this year. You could have a multiple loss conference champion in the ACC this year, especially with what we think is going to be a year where offense in the league is probably going to be really down.
Decent amount of this, as it always will, but perhaps you'll have even more this year with the fact that Florida State plays Alabama. You have two ACC-SEC matchups now. I'm not sure how much either of those teams are going to be involved when you look at Georgia Tech and Tennessee, but when you start to have narratives of conferences be made, and we've seen that those can be tried to be formed real early, and once the ball gets rolling in that direction, that could be tough on a particular conference. But that's always going to be the situation when you've got 5, as much as the Big 12 isn't always becoming of a Power 5 conference, and you've got 5 conferences, 4 spots. You're always looking at a situation where you could be left out, and I agree with you. When you have a potential regression on offense as much as you do in the conference, something we talked about last week as well, maybe everybody does have a blemish and nobody has played a particularly enticing style of football, and you lose a little bit of a PR battle nationally, and you're the fifth chair, or you're the fifth person standing with a 4 chairs on the floor. So I think that's always going to be an option, but I think you're right to point out some circumstances that potentially make this year perhaps a little bit higher of likelihood.
So I don't necessarily want to go predicting FSU's record at this point because I feel like that's just too early to do so. But if you want to just do a quick and dirty method for evaluating something like this, something you can do if you're driving in your car, right? What I like to do is sort of separate games into a couple different categories. And the first category I have is just locks, right? These are games where it would just be an absolute shock if Florida State lost this game. Like something had to go seriously, seriously wrong, and the season is just completely shot down if they lose these games. And I have a couple here. I'm going to list them off. Louisiana Monroe is 1. I think at Wake Forest is 2. At Duke is 3. Honestly, I think at Boston College is 4. I know I may regret that, but I do think that you should still handle him. That offense is just not anywhere close to being able to compete with you, I don't think. That's 4. Hosting Syracuse is 5. And then hosting Delaware State is 6. which leaves six more games. And you're going to be anywhere from an underdog like Alabama and maybe at Clemson. Heck, don't know what the Florida line will be at this point, to, you know, a small favorite like hosting Miami or Louisville, to kind of a moderate favorite like maybe NC State, although I think NC State might be a tougher game than Miami there. Those are all interesting games to me. And basically, do you think we can safely assume 6-0 for projection purposes against the first six that I named?
Sure hope so, man. It would be tough to see a situation where just the Jimmies and Joes would allow any other outcome other than a win in those six.
I mean, I know that mathematically, if you are a real, you know, kind of math honk, you're in your car thinking, well, Bud, even if those are 99% and you know, basically multiply them all together, you're not going to have 100% probability. It's probably 90. But for just kind of quick and dirty driving your car, we're not getting calculator out because we're not texting and driving and doing a lot of foolishness. 6-0 against that essentially leaves an expectation with 10, you know, if you're looking to win 10 games in the regular season, that you're going to go 4-2 against Alabama, Miami, NC State, Louisville, at Clemson, and at Florida. If you want to go over this, you basically have to go 5-1 or 6-0 against that group. If you want to bet under, you're basically saying that they're going to lose three of the six, which is why I think the 10 is a pretty good number. Now, Vegas doesn't really want to throw the 10 out there because the chance that FSU goes 10-2 is actually pretty high. And if they actually go 10-2, guess what? You don't win or lose. You push. Mm-hmm. And the Vegas has got to give your money back. They don't really want to do that, which is why you see, I think, 10.5 and then 9.5, and they adjust for the inequality there with sort of, you know, pricing of the odds and essentially the juice or the vig. If you're going to bet over, though, that essentially means you think Florida State is either going to beat Alabama, go 12-0, beat Alabama, have only one slip up, or lose to Alabama and then run the table. Those are kind of your options there. Other than that, it's a very narrow window you have to get into, which is why I think a lot of people, at least judging by like the Facebook reactions when I put this on Tomahawk Nation, they were kind of, what, 10-2? That, you know, that would not, probably not be a playoff season. But Florida State is not odds on to make the playoff, right? They're plus odds to make the playoff. I think the only two teams that are actually, you know, odds on to make the playoff are maybe Ohio State and Alabama at this point. Other than that, everybody else is kind of fighting for a playoff spot. Not that Alabama and Ohio State are not, but they're not, you know, more likely than not to go, which is kind of what the early odds say.
I don't. I certainly love the optimism of fan bases, but I would have to ask any particular fan what they've seen last year or what they've seen over the past 2 years that makes you think you're an absolute, you know, not a sure thing, but a better bet than not to go to the playoffs. I mean, you just, that's a hell of a schedule that we've talked about, a trip to Clemson and some of the other spots there that we've discussed, Louisville, Miami, not a situation where I think you can look at this roster with some of the questions, particularly some of the questions on different parts of the offense, and think that you can confidently project yourself into one of those four places. Certainly something that we've got a lot of time to talk about and return and review throughout the summer. Perhaps that was just a nice little initial look at over-under, and we'll have to see how that moves between now and kickoff.
I'm really glad you said that, too, because I feel like we need to make sure we clarify this, right? Saying that you don't know what people think or have seen to make them think that, hey, this team is more likely than not to go to the playoff. I think you can actually say that with every single team out there, with probably the exception of Alabama and Ohio State, right? Other than that, everybody else is sort of outside looking in, hoping to go. And that is reflected in roster talent and coaching. I mean, those two schools have the most talent in college football and the best two coaches in college football. Everybody else is probably fighting for third, realistically, and that's just kind of the way it is. But we can flip this question on its head. What teams out there are you reasonably confident are better than Florida State entering the season? Because I think personally for me, I've only got two.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serious. I'm not saying I'm confident Florida State's the third best team, but I'm saying if I had to rank teams out there, I'm probably going Ohio State 1, Alabama 2. right? Might flip it, but in some order. And then three, I think there's a decent group of like probably 5-6 teams that you could maybe put 3-8. I think that helps demonstrate the uncertainty. You know, if you told me, hey, I have Florida State as my number three team, I got no problem with that. Even number two, whatever. You know, maybe you have a lot of confidence. That's cool. If you have them eight, I'd be interested to see who you have ahead of them, but I wouldn't say that's crazy. I mean, I don't think you're trying to produce like clickbait content. If you have like 15 or something, I probably would. But man, going into this year, I think there's only just eyeballing it. There's only two teams that I'm really confident I would take over FSU on a neutral site.
I think this year is particularly interesting, Bud, because there's factors and assets of this team that can give you a lot of variance in how you feel. Like, you can be authentic and think that this is one of the better rosters in college football. You can look at that defense and to say that you've got two kids that are probably going to go in the top 10 of the draft at some point. You might have one of the better defensive tackles in the country. You've got a proven defensive end, and you've got a rookie phenomenon who may challenge for the career sack numbers by the time he leaves. And you've got some other really talented pieces in that secondary other than the two kids that I mentioned at the beginning. At the same time, if you want to have concern, you can identify a real legitimate concern at each particular place on the offensive line. You can have concerns legitimately about your quarterback's accuracy and other aspects of the offense that you hope he picks up. And the wide receivers have never given you a whole lot of confidence for a while as well. So you can look at this roster and be very justified in being wildly optimistic. And you can look at this roster and look at that schedule and say, 9-3 may be more likely than anything else.
I mean, I think 9-3 is more likely than 12-0. And I think, 10-2 is probably a little bit more likely than 11-1. But I don't think 8-4 is that much more likely than 12-0. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If you told me this team goes undefeated, it wouldn't shock me. I mean, it would surprise me just because it's so hard to do it. Even in the regular season, I'm not talking about 15-0, but just the ability to go 12-0 that we've seen it twice in the last 4 years doesn't change how difficult it is to do, right? Just expand it back further and see how many other times FSU or really anybody in a real league is able to do it. Hell, I got questions about this defensive coaching staff, right? I don't think they suck like every other Facebook commenter seems to think, but and I don't think that 2015 shouldn't be accounted because that defense absolutely carried that putrid offense that year. I mean, that was the reason that team went 10-2 in the regular season. If that defense was as bad as people on Facebook seem to think it was, that team would have gone 6-6 because that offense really wasn't very good at all. But I got questions about the defense coach staff. I got questions about linebacker. What's Matthew Thomas going to do for you? Is he going to be there? How about Hoskins? You know what I'm saying? I don't know. There's a lot of questions to be answered about this team, and I'm not sure that we got that many answers about it in spring. And that's why, people look at this in a vacuum and they say 10-2, man, that would be such a disappointment. Well, maybe so. I certainly think if you lose twice, that's, a bit of a disappointment maybe. But, man, keep in perspective here. I'm scanning down up and down this sheet. How many other teams do you see, that have an over-under over 10? A couple other teams have 10 even. Looks like to me just Alabama and Ohio State. Everybody else is kind of around that 10 number. And there's a reason they don't hang like 11.5 unless you're, 2010 Boise State and you're playing like a D2 schedule. There's nowhere to bet over, right? Like, hey, Ingram, I'm going to give you a number of 11.5 on Alabama. Well, they're going to get killed with under money because nobody in their right mind is going to bet on somebody going undefeated unless you're just getting crazy stupid odds on it. And you don't want to hang 11 normally because that's a really strong push possibility. So just keep that in mind when you're out there. A Vegas over-under win total of 10 is not necessarily exactly indicative of a 10-2 record prediction.
I think that's a good look at that, and an introductory look at the idea of FSU's over-under number for 2017. Bud, wanted to discuss an idea that we've both kind of bounced back and forth off each other over the past week or so, and that is the idea that, you know, everybody's kind of harping. If you're concerned with Francois, how he projects moving forward, one of the first things that'll come out of your mouth is that you have accuracy concerns with him, and those are pretty justified, particularly if you look at statistics. So I don't want us to just sound like we're just constantly berating a kid, but you and I have been talking about the idea of maybe you see his accuracy improve, but maybe you see some regression from him from the standpoint of the amount of interceptions that he throws. So maybe a little bit of a trade-off here. A term that we used was at times he was just kind of effectively wild in 2016, where he was either going to throw it to his guy, or more frequently, he threw it at a place where nobody in the field was going to catch it. And that was, in a way, a strong contributing factor to the fact that he threw as few interceptions as he did.
Interception percentage, right? Which is, of course, the amount of interceptions thrown relative to passes. DeAndre Francois last year, 7 interceptions on 400 passes. That is actually a really good percentage. You want to guess where that ranks nationally among qualified passers?
Is that in the top 15?
It is, yeah. He's actually 13th nationally in what we'll call interception avoidance. All right. That's really good. And there are some really good names among this list, by the way. Mason Rudolph, Oklahoma State. Mitch Trubisky, North Carolina. Jesse Ertz, Kansas State. Good college quarterback, Brad Kaya, Pat Mahomes, JT Barrett. I don't know if he's quite as good as people think. Gerard Evans at number 19. And then you have some guys who are on the other end of the spectrum. James Morgan, Bowling Green, 4.6%. That's not good. Francois was at a solid 1.8%. So interceptions on less than 2% of his passes. Obviously, his completion percentage, not that good. Pretty clearly here, he was 61st. So top 15 interception avoidance, but 61st in completion percentage among qualified passers. That's not very good. So I think the point you brought up here is really good. And I feel like sometimes we talk about something on the phone and then we don't always do the best job of bringing it to the show, although I think we usually do. And this came up, I was like, you know, I think Francois has a chance to improve his accuracy some, right? I don't know if he's ever going to be like supernatural throw of the football from an accuracy standpoint, but let's say he does improve his accuracy. That means he's throwing more catchable balls to his receivers, right? But it also means he's throwing more balls within, like around his receiver, okay? Just ball, like, because last year there were a number of balls that just his receiver nor the DB just had any shot to catch. Balls are just fired into the ground or into the, you know, like over the players on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm.
If those decrease and the ball ends up around the target more, I think that good things are going to happen. More touchdowns, more yards, a higher completion percentage, maybe more yards per attempt. Those would all be good things. Those would definitely help the offense. But if you're around the strike zone more, you're also going to give up more hits, to use a baseball analogy. Or in this case, you're going to give up more picks because there's just more passes that are potentially going to be, you know, intercepted. Now, the question is his rate going to increase a lot or just the total number? You know, because if he's throwing the ball more, maybe this year he throws 500 instead of 400, who knows? That's something I want to track because I don't really care about the total number as much as I do the percentage. You know, if he can get his completion percentage up to like top 30 in the country or top 35 from number 61, which is, you know, kind of dreadful, you know, then maybe he keeps at like 2.75 percentage interception avoidance. That'd be great. What you don't want to have is if he gets in that kind of like really ugly, you know, 3.2, 3.3 range where it's just it's, you know, Josh Dobbs style, 12 picks on 357 throws, know, Tyler O'Connor, the Michigan State kid, not 9 picks on 262. Just you have to. I'm not saying that there's anything really within his control, but it's something I'm going to be watching. Like, yeah, if the completion percentage goes up, can he do that without a corresponding increase in the interception percentage?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe so. It'll be something to watch.
It will be something to watch, and it'll be. I mean, you speak with attention and detail to numbers, and it'll, you know, to an extent, and it always matters when these interceptions are thrown. The other thing about Francois Scheer, really the only that I at least immediately remember, the only mistake he made where you had an idea that it could really immediately change the outcome of the game was the Michigan interception. And I mean at the time where you thought, oh, this could have just, you know, completely turned where this game was headed. And all too often, those are the type of interceptions that you get out of freshmen. So if he's going to throw more picks, that may be a byproduct of something positive. That may be something that's just going to happen in a natural end point of throwing more. You know, if you're throwing within the catching radius of your own receiver more times than not, there'll be a defender not all that far away. But also continue to look at DeAndre, you know, when those mistakes are made and how impactful they are of the game and how much of a horrible term, but how much of kind of a game manager he turns into as he enters, you know, another season and with that much more experience.
Indeed. And just for folks at home, that's a lot of numbers, all right? And I realize that, let me give you a little baseline here. Maybe I should have started this. Your interception percentage, you know, how often you throw an interception out of how often you throw the ball, 2.5 is about average, okay? So if you're under 2, that's really good. If you're over 3, that's bad. 2.5, you know, kind of in that 225, 275 range, that's kind of the national average among qualified passers. So Francois at 1.8 last year was very good. But that's a good little rule of thumb, maybe if you think about it. 2.5%, okay, whatever. Over 3, we got a problem. Under 2, that's pretty great. Of course, over 3 and under 2, you also might have a significant amount of luck, be good luck or bad luck, and that's likely to regress some in either direction. But just something to keep an eye on, and I like to share, you know, stats on a podcast when we can. I realize stats sometimes in a podcast form don't work quite as well as they do on a website.
But let's pause momentarily to remind everyone of our friends at Madison Social. Been with us since day one, always a great partner for us, and we always appreciate the support they've provided. Favorite thing about Madso for me is how kind of interwoven they are with this fan base and also how interwoven they are with the community, and always doing something unique. And the most recent example, I know that they are having a little promo, Monday night promo, where you get your second drink free, but also a chance to watch Dancing with the Stars. Sounds kind of strange for me to bring up on a college football podcast, but people in Tallahassee maybe have a little bit more of a keen interest in Dancing with the Stars this year, as Tallahassee-owned David Ross, ex-Braves, Cubs, and many other professional baseball team catcher, is in the finals and has been greatly aided by the local community of Tallahassee, Florida State fans, and then also a whole lot of Cubs fans as well. But a lot of people getting together to watch a local kid, local son, compete in one of the larger TV competitions there is.
That's pretty cool, and I'm glad that they're having an event to kind of honor him, and they'll have it on. I understand this is Monday night, so assuming you're listening to this on Monday morning or Monday during lunch, or even maybe Monday early evening, you can get on over there to Madso. I think that comes on at 8, or maybe the party starts at 8. By the way, has anybody seen like a more just kind of meteoric rise in like one season than David Ross? Like, he plays his entire career. He's like a fine catcher, you know, good defensively, whatever, not a great hitter. And then, boom, he's like Grandpa Ross of the of like the baby Cubs, who are like the most talented team in the world. And all of a sudden, boom, they win the World Series. the curse is broken. He gets like a book deal and he's on Dancing with the Stars and might actually win it because he played for like 11 teams and they're all their fan bases loved him. Like just a year ago, your average Good Morning America viewer would not know who David Ross was. And now, I mean, he's everywhere.
Not a chance. Not a chance.
And it wasn't like he had like that amazing of a season. It was like historic as far as it was magical, but it wasn't like, you know, we didn't come close to winning the MVP or anything. He did hit a home run in Game 7, which is excellent timing, obviously. But that's pretty cool. I'm not sure about his social, what it does to go off on a huge tangent on David Ross during the middle of their ad read, but hey, that's what you get sometimes during the off season. Point number two here with Madison Social, their brunch is really good. And Tallahassee has long needed good brunch places. I love how they have their open patio with the fan. So if it gets hotter, you know, as we go on towards the summer, you stay nice and cool. A lot of really fun, creative options here. They posted one on their Instagram that had a lot of people reacting with, "I saved my cheat day for this." And it is, they described it as, "When life hands you lemons, find ricotta, blackberries, and pancake batter. The lemon ricotta pancake stack is fire." And indeed, it does look fire on my computer screen. They also have the fried chicken and waffles, which is really good. I have actually had that. I have not had the lemon ricotta blackberry stack, but that looks really good too. As did the Cuban hot dog from Township, their sister restaurant there, part of the Four of the Table group. There's a lot of great things there in Tallahassee. We tried to describe that on the last podcast. A couple of you let us know that the Cuban sandwich is actually invented in Tampa, not Cuba. So we do appreciate that. And then Edward Lee Kennedy V hit us up on Twitter.
Hell of a name, by the way. That's strong.
Man, the fifth. Yeah, we should send this guy a gift card just for being the fifth of his name. That's pretty badass. He added For the Table. Got to like when people add our sponsors. And he added the Nolcast. And he said, "When Bud Elliott described your Cuban dog, I just couldn't resist. And he took a very high-quality photo of it, which is solid, before taking a bite." We always like, if you're going to tweet us photos of the food, don't eat half it first. That's good. And he also used hashtag NOLCAST, hashtag For the Table. And for that, we're going to send Edward a gift card. We have gift cards now. So exceptional fan interaction. We like people to support us, support our sponsors. And they confirm that our reads on the food are indeed good and that Cuban dog is good. Hit up Township, hit up Madso, hit up Central, and keep supporting us. We love that. And Edward, will be getting that gift card out to you shortly.
Another kind of broad, general conversation that we had about the offense was the idea that perhaps the offense as a whole takes a step back when it's judged by its peers from a national perspective, but actually moves up in its conference ranking, just to kind of continue a conversation that we had last week. With the broader idea that you may see a significant regression in the offenses of the whole of the ACC. So perhaps you slide back in your national numbers when compared to 2016, but the unit in itself, when judged against its peers in conference, is actually better versus that of what you had in the previous year, if that makes sense.
Indeed. And just to kind of illustrate this point, Ingram, you know where FSU ranked last year yards per play in conference games in the ACC?
I don't. This will be an absolute guess. Six?
Tied for fourth.
Okay.
So, you know, that's fine. They were behind, obviously, Louisville, Pitt, which had, man, they went on a nice run second half of the year on offense. That's probably why LSU grabbed their offensive coordinator. And Clemson. Louisville was the clear outlier. I mean, their yards per play in conference is they put up the same yards per play in conference last year that the 2013 Noles did. 7.6.
Not bad.
That's
not bad.
Ridiculous.
it's a shame Florida State didn't do anything to contribute to that average.
God. Yeah. Man, we got people driving to work. They don't want to think about that.
Very good point. Not that it matters. Who did they tie with for fourth in conference?
North Carolina.
Okay.
Do you think North Carolina will tie them again this year? I don't.
I'd be surprised. Be surprised they had the same output that they had last year.
Yeah. So last year, the Noles against FBS teams were 20th nationally yards per play, right? And that actually offense last year wasn't as bad as people thought it was, right? They actually played a lot of good defenses and they accomplished some nice stuff. 6'4", 8", 6'5", pretty good, 20th nationally, but tied for fourth in their league. I'll posit to you that this year, they actually might go down a little bit in the national ranking. Like, I don't know if they'll necessarily be 20th, but I think they could actually be better within the conference. Okay, let's take a look at the people around them. Miami with either guy who had one scholarship offer or a true freshman quarterback who did not enroll early. I like Florida State. UNC without Mitch Trubisky and without Switzer kid and a couple other key pieces. I like Florida State. Pitt without their offensive coordinator and without that transfer quarterback Peterman. Again, I like Florida State over them. Louisville. I'm probably still going to take Louisville. They have the Heisman winner. But again, that's the first team that I'm actually confident will have a better offense than FSU in the league. And then Clemson, I don't know. I might take Clemson over Florida State. I might not. I think that you're going to see Florida State move up at least one, maybe two spots. And I would be surprised. I'll say it. I would be very surprised if Florida State does not have a top three offense in the league this year.
But good point. I have to say I probably agree with you. I would expect this offense to be in the top three places in the conference. Questions abound in different places, but still the amount of skill that you have and the schedule that you have, I would expect that. And something we'll be able to look back and see whether or not that comes to fruition. Okay, so two lookbacks at different parts of the offense as far as what you're going to see out of quarterback and accuracy, and then also maybe overall production numbers and when compared to the conference and nationally. But it's interesting to look at this fan base, and this is always going to happen to an extent because people that follow college football rarely sit in the middle of anything. It's normally one way or another, but an awful lot of polarization, perhaps more than normal, as far as people's ideas as to what the offense is going to be, whose fault it will be if the offense isn't what people think it should be. A lot of people that appear to be pretty set in their minds as to what things look like headed into the year.
Yeah, and I'm just going through kind of some of the feedback we get. And look, I know that people who actually write feedback on, you know, and write like angry 1,000-word emails of feedback on things, or even the people on Twitter, I know those don't represent the average fan. Those are like your real passionate fans who are out there debating. Most fans don't do that. But I am noticing that it feels like very few people out there are along the lines of like, there are multiple questions, right? It feel like everybody's either super offensive line sucks or super, I don't know if DeAndre is the right guy, or super, I don't know if we can trust these receivers, right? Or super, everything's fine. There are no questions about this team. Guys, it's okay to have multiple doubts or multiple confidences. What I'm noticing, I feel like just because somebody says, you know, hey, the offensive line has got to work on protection. And then somebody else says, well, Francois has to get rid of the ball quicker and has to be more accurate on first down so he doesn't put the offensive line in quite so many situations where, you know, it's 3rd and 9, the defense knows it's a pass and it's a hard position to block. Both of those guys are right. Just because we may present one viewpoint on a podcast one day and another next, those are not necessarily contradicting viewpoints. In fact, I think this team does have multiple questions. Maybe we haven't done a good enough job addressing that, but man, I have major questions about the offensive line going into this year, and about Francois, and about the quarterback or about the receiver consistency, and all those things are okay. I mean, obviously we want them to work out well. I'm not saying like it's okay if they suck, but you know, you see what I'm saying? Like, I just saw him noticing.
It's something that I've noticed as well, and it's interesting to see how much people will fall into one camp or another when it comes to either this thing's going to fall apart because of the offensive line and the coach, the wide receivers and the coach. And look, there's some real legitimate concerns about the consistency of both of those units. And doesn't mean that those things don't exist, but a lot of just kind of a single idea as to if the team, like, team's going to be good, team's going to be bad. Team's going to be good, team's going to be bad because of this coach, this position. Just a whole lot more of a complicated equation than that. And not something I'm sure that we're going to be able to completely classify as to the fortunes of this team because of a particular unit, at least at this point in the year.
Yeah, I totally agree. I had a Gator fan ask me this, and I feel like he's a very smart Gator fan and not one of those just kind of mouth breather Gators. He said, hey, I love your site. Am I missing something? Like that all these FSU fans just assume that Florida State receivers are better than Florida's? And at first I was kind of like, yeah, of course they are, right? Like Florida's offense has sucked. And but yeah, he's a bright guy. So like, oh, I'm going to think about this. And I went and looked at it. And this might actually be closer. And I can't believe we're doing this on an FSU podcast. But, you know, hey, we're not really a fanboy show. You know, they do have a lot of talent in that receiving core. I mean, if you went one for one, right, like going into the season, are you going to take Antonio Callaway or Nooney?
Yeah, I would probably go Callaway, and pretty confidently.
I mean, Callaway's more proven, right? Ability-wise, they may be close, but Callaway's definitely shown he can do it on the big stage more frequently than Nooney. Okay, so that's kind of a feather in UF's cap. Who do you like as your number two? Is it Auden Tate? Is it Keith Gavin? I love Keith Gavin. I like Auden Tate too. Tyree Cleveland is a freakish talent over there in Gainesville as well. If that's their number two, I mean, I feel like I don't think either side is better there. They are both teams have a guy as their number two with just almost unlimited upside and yet major questions about consistency and experience. So there's not really a major advantage there. At tight end, I mean, Goolsby was pretty good for them last year. I know they like Ciante Lewis some. I think Florida State's tight ends are better, to be honest, especially when you factor in blocking. UF also has Brandon Pallett, receiver, who's kind of a hybrid guy. Man, I'm not so sure that I think a lot of this is because of just how unproven they are. But I think I'm not so sure that Florida State's receivers are a slam dunk better than UF's. I think quarterback right now is, until we see anything from Felipe Franks, because Francois is a good quarterback. He's not great by any stretch, but he's not terrible. But the receiver, that was an interesting comment. I thought it would be kind of a thought exercise because I bet you a lot of listeners had the same initial reaction that I did, that of course they're better.
I mean, I would take Callaway pretty consistently just because of the consistency that he's displayed. I mean, Nooney can be wildly frustrated and frustrating, and at the same time, you can look at him and be like, man, you're so like physically gifted and talented. It's crazy. You just don't know. I'm not sure you can feel real comfortable that I would love to look back after six or eight games and have Nooney Murray playing at the level that we know he can and start to get the consistency from that kid. But until he does that, I'm not sure that you could really take Callaway or him over Callaway. And really, you know, look, if this is the roster, if this is the particular roster spot that you're going to want to break down, that's probably a pretty good sign for Florida State that you're examining wide receivers if you're Florida fans because you think that's the place where your level or perhaps superior talent. Obviously, it's a conversation that you would only have during the dead period of summer and when fans and rivals tend to examine each other's depth chart, but it's a conversation worth having, and I agree with you. It's not necessarily the reaction that I would have made when I first thought about it, but the more you look at that, I don't have any problem if some Florida fan were to say to me that he would prefer his own roster over ours.
And if you are talking to a Florida fan who is kind of a particular mouth breather, just say, does Callaway play quarterback? No. Okay, well, then great. It doesn't necessarily matter if you don't want me to throw the ball. Congratulations.
Is this going to be another year we beat you 27-0 again? No, that was 27-2. Oh, you're right. You're right.
That's still the best. is telling them that you beat them 27-0 and then making them correct the record to show
you know, 27-2, damn it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that is right. I forgot about the two.
Man, you get those 2 points. Get them Gators. I love doing that. That is, I'm like, 27-0, get that shutout. What? No, we scored two. And then they'll hold up their phone to show you, like so proud that they scored 2 points at home.
Very funny. Great. Very funny. But one thing we just talked about, kind of a final back and forth we had that I wanted to mention was, I've seen a lot in the fan base recently about the idea of the Champions Club. I know that this is something that Stan Wilcox made some public comments on and that Corey Clark recently had an article about. But it's been kind of an issue that I would describe as kind of simmering among the fans over the summer. I've had a lot of people reach out to me about particular rumors about seating arrangements or what type of steps that they might take to make that a little bit more of a presentable part of the stadium when it comes to either a television broadcast or the way it looks from the sideline if you're a recruit or any other person that consumes a Florida State football game. But something that there's been a lot of talk about from the fan base, and just wanted to spend 4 or 5 minutes going over our own individual opinion of what the Champions Club is and what the Champions Club ultimately will be.
Yeah, Angerman, I think we've seen a lot of the same complaints, right? And it's, hey, there are empty seats up there. Yeah, there are. And I think this is, I would split this into two separate issues. The first is, weren't there empty seats before? Because I think they were. And before we hit record, I'll kind of pull back the curtain here. Ingram said, guess what? There used to be even more empty seats up there. And they were the seats you would give away to, like, local band day, right? It's like you find 10 groups of 80 and there's 800 seats filled, right? For free. Or $2 a ticket, right? Mm-hmm. Or the Boys and Girls Clubs or what have you. There are probably less empty seats now than there were before. And I think that point you made was great. But the other point, and I think you can kind of take this and run with it, is that they're a little bit more obvious now because of the placement and because of something you pointed out that I thought was really smart.
So the placement, the way that you've kind of carved the stadium out, it's always going to be something that people's eyes are inclined to notice when they first look at the stadium, particularly if you've got an aerial shot from a blimp or anything else like that. And there's parts of this that you can control if you're Florida State, and there's parts that you're not going to be able to control. Like, you're not going to be able to control the general idea as to what this is, and that is that you took the worst seats in the stadium and you're able to sell them at a premium now. At the same time, you took the worst seats of the stadium, and on one side, there's looking straight into the Florida sun, and it's really hot as hell in Tallahassee, can be hot as hell in Tallahassee up until, what, maybe the second week of October? I mean, it's a long summer. And that's on one side, and on the other side is air conditioning and bourbon and people, you know, who go and have a good time. And I'm not saying that if you go to those seats, you're not necessarily like a diehard football fan, but it's not the greatest vantage point. And a lot of times it's easy to go in and have two or three drinks or catch up with a friend for 10 or 12 minutes or maybe longer, and the game slides by and you're not there. That's just something that's a byproduct of what you carved out of the stadium and built into it. There's also smaller, easier things that you can control if you're Florida State. And I've got to really, and I think I said this immediately when we first started looking at this last year, but
you did. If what you're going to say is what I think you're going to
say. Why was the idea, and why did we move forward with putting that wave of gold throughout it? That screams occupied or unoccupied open seats, whether you look at it from the sideline and you're a recruit, whether it's the aerial shot that I referenced. It's just a highlighter to the fact that you have seats that in all likelihood are never going to be occupied. You could talk about putting misters out there. You could talk about having people that may bring you a hot dog or beer or liquor drink or whatever it may be. more times than not, those seats are going to be empty. But the idea that we made those two-tone is seemingly really shooting yourself in the foot and drawing to the eye that those are just big, empty swaths of unoccupied seats in your stadium.
It was a good point when you made it, and it's still a good point, man. I mean, it's just, ugh. Yeah. I don't think they have more empty seats now than they used to. I do think that it's not a great look, and I think you're exactly right with the paint job thing. Now, the one thing that we don't have here is the benefit of time, right? We had Jerry Cutts on the podcast, and we asked him some of this stuff, and he said, look, we're satisfied with how many mm-hmm. we sold in year one, and we're very satisfied with how many more events we're being able to do. You know, the Doak After Dark and the Country Concert Series and all that stuff that they've been able to get. And they've been able to get more events to Doak. And I'm sure the Champions Club has helped in doing some of that. What we don't really have here is, you know, the benefit of seeing what year two and year three and year four are like. I think I would take your advice if I was them, and I would change the color scheme to something that would minimize you know, how much your eye is drawn to that empty part of the stadium, right? If it is still empty. And they may think it's not going to be empty, but is that a chance you really want to take? I don't know how much it would cost to repaint that. Probably not that much. You know, it's not that huge of a section. It just happens to be the section that shows up every time somebody kicks a field goal or an extra point in the south end of the stadium, which, you know, is fairly often. I buy that they were relatively okay with how many sold in year one. Have you seen any kind of like uptick in or any kind of news about there being an uptick in sales for year two?
I haven't seen anything if it's out there. I don't think the conversation about the Champions Club necessarily is that it's not successful or that they weren't happy with how it was received. It's just more about the way it looks and it's about, you know, the fact that, yeah, there may be tons of people in there, but it's just not a great look for a place that places the priority of college football that Florida State does. And all of these things, but, you know, like the college football arms race that we talk about all the time, it's kind of shallow in and of itself. Like, you're not necessarily going to get a kid, say, who will commit to you because you've got a slide that goes down a story and a half in your football facility or whatever, but it's that maybe you appear on a kid's radar that you wouldn't have otherwise because he watched like the YouTube of that when he was in 10th grade or 9th grade, or you just have things that you can show from a distance to catch kids' eye and kind of eye candy, and then ultimately once they get on campus, a kid more times than not makes their decision based off the scheme and how comfortable he was with the coaches, et cetera, et cetera. But it can be a great way to have somebody introduced to your program and have an interest. And I'm not trying to be overly dramatic here, but it's just not a great look, and it doesn't scream that this place is as into college football as it is when you have just this massive swath of the stadium that is not only unoccupied, but it's seemingly like gone out of its way to make it all the more noticeable that it is regularly large pieces of it have virtually no one sitting in those seats.
Edgar, what if we made them highlighter color?
Highlighter color.
Right.
Yes.
Let's just embrace it. Right?
Screaming.
Kind of go full Oregon.
Screaming yellow neon. That would be great.
Or like alternating lights. what if we had like hologram fans? Like we could CGI
absolutely, you could do that. Really, the only thing is something creative like that, or you know, maybe university employees get into the game for free, but there's a strong understanding that they're going to be seated in those seats for the vast majority of the games, or something like that. I mean, you're just going to have. I don't think you can tell any fan like, hey, you're gonna go to the game, sir, and you're gonna spend time outside. That's, you know, obviously not anything that you have the ability to do. You can try to make that as enticing and as comfortable as possible, but that place is limited as far as what you can do to make those seats outside real appealing. And we saw even in a game as much talent as there was on the field and how important the game was, it's not as though the opponent changed that. I mean, that place was empty for Clemson as well. Again, the club itself wasn't empty, but all of the seats out there and what you see if you consume the game from afar, it certainly appeared empty.
I wonder, can you buy a Champions Club membership without a seat?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Because I wonder if you made the section more narrow, right? Like if they just said, okay, people love the bar, and they love being able to see their friends, and love the air conditioning, and they love being able to look out and watch the game. Maybe the solution is to make the actual seating section narrow and sell a certain percentage of championship club memberships without seats.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
right.
You know, narrow it down, sell those seats on the edges kind of as normal seats. They probably fill some. Some of those people at the very, you know, in the very tops of the stadium would probably move down. They don't get Champions Club access. They do get a little closer to the field. And then your section of like glaring emptiness is reduced. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great idea, bud. I think that may be something that's possible, that you see some kind of subdivision there as far as what parts of the Champions Club experience you take place in. And that's, I imagine there's probably some kind of, I don't know if it's like fire marshal, or there probably has to be some kind of ratio from how many people you have in there to the seats that are sold. But exploring the idea of a Champions Club ticket that doesn't necessarily have a seat accompanying to it is a good one, and not something that I had ever thought of.
I could see it for like corporate memberships, right? Like, okay, hey, you get with this 10 people can access Champions Club, but it only comes with 5 tickets, 2 seats, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, half the group can sit if they want, whatever. The whole 10 people can't sit at the same time in the seats, which granted, if you have a group of 10, it's hard to like actually like talk to each other during the game anyway, because how long that is, unless you go like, you know, 2 rows stacked or whatever, 5, but
something to think about. Anything else you wanted to mention tonight?
I think we're good, man. I think we'll do 2 this week. Maybe a recruiting podcast out for the weekend. Probably got to see sort of how Florida State resets its board. I've run into a lot of Florida State's coaches on the road this spring so far at different high schools, and most high schools in the state, I know a couple kind of in the middle part of the state are still going, but most high schools in the state are getting ready for graduation, and spring ball wrapped up with spring jamborees Thursday and Friday. Got a chance to see Quayshon Fuller, the 2019 defensive tackle out of South Fort Myers High. Got a chance to see Brad Lawing out there, watching him among other prospects. And we'll talk about all that on our next episode. Should be a good one.
There was a boy, a very strange enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little shy and sad of eye, but very wise was he. And then one day, a magic day, he passed my way. And while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me.